The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So in taking questions today from the chat, there's a first question. You mentioned that while settled in our meditation, that Buddha is not concerned with essence. Can you expand on this? Yeah, it depends what we mean by essence. But what Buddha is not concerned about is any kind of essence which is a fixed, solid, unchanging essence, something like a soul or a core aspect of consciousness, there is nothing enduring. And if there's an essence in Buddhism, it's the essential process nature of life. And that process sense, everything's a process, everything is an unfolding. And we can't point to something as being the thing which is the essence, but there is essential processes, and those processes are unfolding in all kinds of ways, and some of them are much more intimate and deeply connected and feel most intimate and liberating and freeing and loving within us. And some are quite removed from what really feels essential or feels core or something. So it depends on how we define it, but I hope that that's a good enough answer. I don't know how to address the lies I hear read in the news. I think the more concerned, so what occurs to me in answering that question is the more concerned we are with such things, one possible response is to dedicate yourself to being the opposite of that concern. And the more you're concerned about the lies that are spreading around, work more on being truthful, and don't assume that we're all truthful just because we want to be or we think we are. There are probably layers and layers of truthfulness and honesty and self-deception and all kinds of things that go on. And we can get more skilled in being truth tellers and in useful ways, in ways that are useful for ourselves and useful for others. And begin there. And as part of that, also learn about the reactivity that we might have around what we read in the news. Do we succumb to anger, to despair, to discouragement? And is that really useful for anyone for us to do that? And what would it be like to clearly discern and see some of the things that are amiss in the wrong in the world, that to really feel wrong, and not lose our peace because of it, but also not become aloof from it or indifferent to it, but motivated in some way, motivated to make a difference. Can you talk about how you synthesize the different schools of Buddhism in which you studied and practiced? So I've really been involved in two major traditions of Buddhism. The Zen tradition, Japanese Zen tradition, that belongs to the Mahayana school of Buddhism, wing of Buddhism, and then that Theravadan school of Buddhism, the Buddhism of Thailand and Burma in particular. And I find, and within those traditions, you know, I was doing meditation, and meditation practice was really at the heart of both traditions. And what I learned in Zen really helped me to be able to do Vipassana practice in a deeper way. It prepared me. It was like preparation for it. So it was a very good preparation for me. And both traditions, you know, all forms of Buddhism have both strengths and weaknesses. And sometimes it's useful to kind of be involved with two different traditions so we see those strengths and weaknesses better and somehow can compensate for them or find the right balance in working them. Sometimes it doesn't work so well to do two traditions at the same time unless there's a lot of similarity. But what I did was I did 10 years of intensive Zen practice, and then I got involved in Vipassana practice. And then I did a lot of intensive Vipassana. And at some point, I kind of rode both of them kind of equally in a certain kind of ways. But the complementarity of them was very helpful for me. So in terms of their synthesis, the question was how I synthesize them. I think that I synthesize them in my body. Somehow, in my way of being, the best, I hope the best in both, got somehow incorporated and worked together in some kind of harmony. In my intellect, the way I think about things and understand, I have a little bit from both traditions, and how they synthesized or how there was a selective process, that's maybe a big topic. What does it mean that mindfulness, energy, and concentration are both in the five faculties and seven factors of awakening, but some others are in only one list or the other? Well, perhaps one thing is that because mindfulness, energy, and concentration are in both lists, it means that these are really core parts of meditation practice, that mindfulness and concentration are at the heart of it, and we have to do it. The usual word for energy in the seven factors of awakening and the five faculties is virya, which isn't just quite energy, but rather it's more closely related to application, the effort we make, and the strength by which we make some effort. So, I like to joke sometimes that meditation doesn't work at all, and then I pause, as if that's the end of it. And then I add the last phrase, meditation doesn't work at all unless you do it. And so mindfulness and concentration require some engagement, some doing, some application, and that's the energy or the effort factor. And why are others only in one list or the other? I think because each of these is focusing on different aspects of or subsets of our whole kind of path of practice. So seven factors of awakening and five faculties, I think that they're meant to be core practices, core aspects of meditation practice. Or let's say it this way. I know seven factors of awakening are most related to meditation practice itself and assumes there's been faith. And it's a means to wisdom. So it sits between those two. The five faculties encompasses mindfulness, energy, concentration, but adds faith and wisdom. And so it's a little bit wider span of practice. So it's more encompassing of more elements of what the full embodied kind of practice would involve. Some kind of faith or confidence in something and some wisdom or insight that gets developed. So it depends on what's being focused on. How can I reconcile the ideas of being authentic to oneself and making decisions about what to do with the ideas of not-self? It's a very good question given what Buddhist teachings is about not-self. Generally, I'd encourage you to both don't take this not-self teaching too seriously and take it seriously. It's all in context. But don't take it so seriously that you try to believe, like you think it's something you have to believe or something you have to somehow act accordingly without really, understanding what it's about. But it is serious as something that we come to understand or see, have insight in meditation or as practice really gets deep. It happens in other times in life as well sometimes where things are deeply seen in a liberating way, very, very impersonal in the best sense of that term. But it's not like this not-self thing is not something you have to believe. And so being authentic is a beautiful thing. I think of that being honest and being truthful. And please, by all means, do that. And if, in a simple way, it means you're being truthful to yourself. In a general way, that's okay to talk about that. It's, we are talking about this psychophysical being here. And the not-self teaching is really about not getting caught up in some singular, essential idea that there is the self, a self, that you're accountable to. We are accountable to the whole psychophysical process that's here. And having that psychophysical process be in harmony and be honest, not being caught in delusion, not be caught up in greed, hate, and delusion, and unskillfulness. And so we are kind of accountable to what's here, for sure. And being authentic is a beautiful expression if it frees us from all these unskillful ways of being. Time and time again, I come up against anxiety that arises when I meditate, so much so that even Buddhist talks start giving me anxiety because it is associated with meditation. Have any advice? Yeah. It's possible. This happens to people, and sitting down in meditation sometimes is kind of like taking the lid off from Pandora's box, you know, that there's so much going on internally that we're distracted from, or we're so busy in life doing things that we don't pay attention to, don't feel, don't recognize. And sometimes when meditation is a stopping all the doings, and also a stopping of a lot of thinking and ways we distract ourselves from ourselves, that we discover this reservoir inside of unresolved issues, anxiety, fear. It's pretty common. And a lot of people will have to, as they meditate, will go sooner or later go through a layer of fear or anxiety or unresolved issues that will come up. And some people feel confused because they think meditation is just a one-way ride to more and more calm and peacefulness. But in fact, any spiritual tradition, any real meditation practice that's supposed to go, you know, go deep, will somehow sooner or later flush out or connect you to the places where things are unresolved or difficult or challenging. And rather than being discouraged by that, generally it's good to be encouraged by it. And so if anxiety is a frequent visitor, it's a little hard, you know, just on a, from a chat to really understand the person's, where the person's coming from. So I'll say a few things that the general kind of advice that's pure vipassana, mindfulness advice, is to become a student of that anxiety, to take time to sit in the middle of it and get to know it. Some people have anxiety and they recoil from it, or they're afraid of their anxiety, or they feel like they're not supposed to be anxious. And our anxiety is kind of waiting for us, to really get to know it and feel it and make space for it to resolve itself, to unfold and show what's going on in a deeper way. And so one of the little teachings I like to give about fear and anxiety is to bring our mindfulness to the anxiety, and while we're paying attention to it, being with it, to help the anxiety feel safe. And this idea of helping the anxiety feel safe, mostly it's safe from us, that we're not trying to fix it or chase it away or angry with it, or we're not afraid of it, which makes the anxiety feel kind of lousy, that it's lost the connection with us. But rather the anxiety feels like it's okay to be there. And then it can begin to unfold and move and resolve itself. So this idea of kind of, you know, just being present for it, and really seeing what's there. And sometimes some people find they're just giving themselves over for a while to feel anxious and really sit in the middle of it with a quiet mind, not a mind that keeps spinning stories, that something begins shifting that's very significant. Sometimes with chronic ongoing anxiety, it's useful to spend time with a therapist. There might be some issue, something that's hard to touch or get to, unless with the help of a professional who can ask good questions or can offer a wonderful sense of presence and care, compassion, that allows something inside to open and reveal itself and be seen and be heard from someone else, that makes a huge difference. And a good therapist can also recommend different things that can be done sometimes with anxiety. And with anxiety like this, looking at it, it's best not to be in a hurry. And it's fine to sit at the edges of anxiety for a while and just create a little safety there and just feel it there, and with time go deeper and deeper. I've given talks on fear, and I think if you go look around for, you probably find lots of Dharma teachers who have given talks on fear. And I think sometimes it's useful to make it a major focus of study for a while, to look at fear and learn about it, hear about it, listen to talks about it, and become kind of connoisseur and learn all the different practices we can have about how to practice with fear, anxiety, and become an expert on fearlessness. Because certainly we carry a lot within us, and you might be surprised that you might somewhere in the corner and deep inside your heart or somewhere, you might have some intuition about that which is not afraid. And can you trust that? Can you open to it a little bit or have that as a reference point? What do you think about psychotherapy and meditation? I think that, as I said, that I recommended it as an adjunct for some people. Psychotherapy, just like the word meditation, both those words are so big. It's kind of like saying, someone says, I do sports. That's nice to know that they do sports, but what sports do they do? There's such a wide range of sports that it doesn't really tell you too much what they actually do. So same thing with the word psychotherapy and meditation. There's such a wide range of schools and approaches to psychotherapy and wide range of meditation practices. And there's kind of like a Venn diagram. They kind of overlap in all kinds of ways. And some that they overlap and some ways they don't overlap. Some ways they're mutually supportive and some ways actually they're maybe going in opposite directions and not supportive and helpful for each other. So it's a little bit hard to, But I certainly recommend psychotherapy sometimes, and my favorite form of psychotherapy, there's many of them that I have a lot of respect for, but in my capacity as a mindfulness teacher, I really like forms of psychotherapy that have a somatic basis. So not so much talk-centric, but rather body-centric, kind of helping the person go through their body, their sensations, and really supports an embodiment. And also, it's not directly with psychotherapy, but I have something, maybe it's a little bit risky to say this, maybe it's not quite right, but with those caveats, so you don't take me too seriously, and you maybe think about it some. I have a lot of respect for psychotherapy, but what's happened in some corners of our society, especially here in California, is that, but I think much of maybe modern society in the United States, we've become, the culture has been heavily influenced by 100 years of psychology and psychotherapy and psychoanalysis, and it's entered into our culture in such a deep way so that now we're much more concerned about, parents are much more concerned with the psychological health and well-being of their children in a way that wasn't the case 50, 60, 70 years ago. And sometimes the excessive interest in this small details of our psychology and psychology of our children is counterproductive, and it creates some kind of, it itself creates kind of a excessive self-focus. And occasionally this the self-focus of the psychotherapy, I think, has led people to a certain kind of narcissism at times, certain people. It's not the fault of psychotherapy, but it's maybe a little bit the fault of how some of the values of psychotherapy have entered into our culture more widely. And there's become almost a sometimes invisible kind of narcissism of self-preoccupation that goes on. And it's hidden because it's in the language of psychotherapy, sometimes the language of meditation, which, we're talking about meditation, talking about ourselves and what goes on, but it's a little bit overly done, the self-focus. And part of the function of mindfulness meditation is to help flush out the ways in which we've become too self-preoccupied, maybe a certain narcissism or self-consciousness, which is actually a hindrance and a kind of stress, and help that to dissolve. And if that dissolves and there's less narcissism, I think psychotherapy actually works a lot better and a lot faster. Is it wise to avoid unwholesome friends? If I avoid them, how can I still have metta for them? maybe it's easier to have metta if you avoid them. It depends. Rather than avoiding unwholesome friends, like you're avoiding them, pay attention more to yourself here and their influence on you. And if somehow they influence you so that you become unwholesome or you get excessively stressed or de-stressed or something, then take care of yourself and hold yourself away so that you don't succumb or get caught in that. But if you can be with them in such a way that they don't influence how you are, and you can stay balanced and stay not get absorbed some of these unskillful ways, maybe it's not so bad to spend time with them if they're still your friends. And so the focus is not really so much thinking about them being unskillful, kind of a little bit critical of them. It's more you focus on how it is for you, and you're trying to take care of yourself the best way. And so, you know, so then also you can ask yourself, well, when and how and where am I with these friends so that they influence me in a way that I don't want to have happen? Maybe if I just go have lunch with them or go for walks with them, or maybe I only talk with them at certain particular points when they're most likely to be in a good place, and maybe I don't spend too much time with them. Maybe, you know, so you can have more choice about how you spend time with them so that it works for you better. At times, you know, if they're your friends, there's probably something you appreciate about them. So maybe you can spend time with them in a situation where that it's easier for you to appreciate that than just have that be the guiding principle. When sitting in a chair to meditate, should I cross legs and ankles? The usual instruction is not to do that in a chair, but rather to have both feet solidly on the floor, on a block or something. And I think there's something valuable about feeling the feet grounded when we're sitting. And it kind of it's a kind of groundedness that we have cross-legged when much of the lower legs are grounded on the, you know, on the mat or on the floor also. And if you cross your legs, it's a little harder to have it have a firm, solid foundation that kind of supports us. And maybe it's an indirect way, but I think that's the usual way. Don't cross. I don't know how important it is, but that's the usual advice. Is meditation effective in healing people with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder? Yes and no. For some people, there's a lot of people who have used meditation to go through and heal from PTSD. And, you know, and when I started meditating, we didn't even have that idea of PTSD. And people would sit with all kinds of symptoms of it, PTSD signs or expressions in them. And they would sit through it and with it and came out the other end. But it can be very hard, depending how strong the PTSD is, and sometimes meditation is even counterindicated, and maybe not even useful if the PTSD is really strong, because it somehow the PTSD can get exasperated or get reinforced, because as we feel it, and it feels so terrifying or so painful that it just kind of adds to the PTSD. So whether it's useful or not useful is really an individual thing. If we know we have it, it's a good thing to come and talk to a meditation teacher about it. And so you have some support. The teacher can offer some particular support and guidance. It's getting pretty common in the last 10, 12 years for the people being trained as, in our scene, being trained as insight meditation teachers to also get trained in some form of a trauma therapy. It's a fairly common phenomena that comes our way, and so having some training in that and recognizing it and know how to offer some support that's trauma-specific, I think, is quite helpful. So maybe, and then also sometimes it's really important to go find a therapist or a modality that for working with trauma that really get help and support, and that really specializes in that and has the care and the love and the expertise to really stay focused and offer a lot of care and support, especially if it's strong. There's no shame in having PTSD. It's I think of it as just a whole natural physiological response to great trauma, great fear and suffering and pain. And it's a lot of it is physiological. And so no shame, don't take it too personally in the sense of that you're a bad person or something's bad with you if you have this. I think actually it's in some ways you can see it as a healthy part of the human responsivity that something really deep has moved physiologically with us with these huge challenges that unfortunately have happened to people. And the art of it or the task of it is to find a way to complete or finish the ways in which what has impacted us in these deep way, to bring it to completion. And sometimes people don't find a way to have this trauma response really pass through us or move complete, and then we get kind of stuck for a long time. And so finding meditation or psychotherapy or something to really help kind of move it through and complete a kind of completion that can happen is really good. So I hope that helps the question about meditation. And I'll repeat the one thing is that if you know you have it and you come to meditate, especially if you come on retreat, meditation retreats, it's good to check in with a teacher about it so that it's you can get direct support. Well, maybe I'll take one more. I'm appreciating the many offerings from IMC. However, I find myself more reluctant to sit on my own. Do you see any danger of becoming dependent on your and others' guidance in meditation? Yes, I think it's a great question, especially now in the pandemic. I do all these guided meditations in a way that I never used to do it, and I just really valued just sitting in silence without having any guidance. I think during the pandemic, it really helps. Guided meditation maybe helps create a living human connection and community and all kinds of things. It's a little bit, odd to sit too silently just on this way. But sooner or later, I hope that people will also start meditating without any guidance, without any guided meditations, and really learn to discover and do it on their own. As people mature in meditation, you want to be able to find a way to meditate that you're really on your own, and whatever comes up when you're meditating alone is really important. And to have a guided meditation, sometimes it's a little bit easier, and sometimes it bypasses some of the important things we have to work through in meditation, and it bypasses some of the strength we want to develop too in meditation. So yes, I agree. It's a good thing to not only do meditation and with under guidance or connection with others the way we've been doing it now, but it's also we have to kind of look at our lives and see what is most supportive and what's available, what's most inspiring, and so what you decide to do. Some of you may be doing the 7 a.m. sittings, which are 30 minutes long. And I'm planning in February when I do a retreat. I think it starts February 14th and maybe on the next one too, which starts February 28th, 7-day retreat, is to maybe make start the 7 o'clock sitting at 6:45. So we have 45-minute sitting. It'll still be guided to some degree, but there'll be more time for silence. The people who just want to keep showing up at 7 can still do so, but we'll start at those 2 weeks to maybe have a chance to sit longer and begin kind of stretching the meditation muscle. For those of you who are getting used to just sitting for 30 minutes, or this was your introduction to all this, to begin stretching and stretching. And at some point, I'll start offering maybe some day longs and maybe it has more silent meditation. And also, I'd encourage you, those of you who have been following along in the pandemic, doing this for many months, sitting with me here or sitting with others, to think about going on a meditation retreat. The online meditation retreats are a wonderful offering, and people are finding them very, very meaningful and helpful, and it's a chance to meditate in community, but some of those, many, many meditations through the day, and many of those will be silent, and you'll be on your own, and in a sense. So I hope that was useful. So thank you, my friends. I hope that this was nice. It was really nice for me to hear what you had to say, what you wrote, and your questions. And I'm going to copy all these because I don't think I got, you know, there were plenty of them that I didn't respond to. So I will. I'm going to make a. I'll copy them before I'll try to. And this computer, the one over there, and then look at them later. So thank you. And next week, Nikki Mirgafori will give the Sunday morning talk, and a wonderful teacher here at IMC, and some of you have probably heard her before. And I'll be back for Sunday. I'll be back in 2 weeks. Thank you.